Monster Man, special episode, The Thing.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Greg. If you'd like to be like Greg and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for other levels, including access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I talk about the myths and religions of the world and how to use them in RPGs. We're currently on a season about Hawaiian mythology, and it's been a lot of fun. So thank you very much for your support, Greg, and I hope that you enjoy the show. Greg has asked me to talk about The Thing. Now, I'm not talking about the idol of millions, the ever-loving blue-eyed thing, Benjamin J. Grimm. I'm talking about John Carpenter's The Thing, parentheses 1982, close parentheses. If you haven't seen this classic, it is a sci-fi horror film in which Kurt Russell and a bunch of other kind of Antarctic explorer scientist types, he's the pilot of the group, are trapped in their base with a shape-shifting alien monster that can adapt to look like any of them. Although it was a failure at the time, like a lot of John Carpenter movies, prior to his run of kind of low-budget hits, like you wouldn't think that, like, They Live and Prince of Darkness are among Carpenter's, like, more successful at the time they were released movies, but because they were so inexpensive, it actually works out that way. Whereas things like The Thing and Big Trouble in Little China were considered failures when they were released and only later became cult classics. Not that Prince of Darkness was well-reviewed, you understand, but it made money. So The Thing is now kind of praised for its gruesome practical special effects, but perhaps more for its atmosphere of tension and paranoia. It's not an original story, of course. It is an adaptation partly of Howard Hawks' film, The Thing from Another World, 1951, and of the 1938 John W. Campbell novella, Who Goes There, on which that film is based. Now, I actually haven't read the Campbell, but my understanding is that the Carpenter is maybe a little closer to the original story rather than to the film that adapted it, but I may be wrong about that. So the creature, the eponymous thing, is a sort of gloopy protean creature capable of taking on any shape, a bit like the protein or protean polymorph in Dungeons and Dragons, which appears in the Fiend Folio and was covered back in season 2. But there are many creatures that are capable of, like, adapting or blending in or changing shape. And we've covered some of them before. I've already done special episodes on, like, shape-changing monsters in general quite recently, and longer ago, doppelgangers. So if you're interested in what I have to say about, like, shape-changing in general, I urge you to go and check out those episodes. There is a search function both on the Patreon and Libsyn sites that you can use to just search for those keywords. I do apologize, like, a long time ago I decided not to give the special episodes numbers, and it'd be weird if I started now, but they probably should have had them initially when there were only a few of them, rather than, like, one a week. It didn't seem like that high a priority. So, live and learn. So, instead, I think we're going to mainly look at the premise of the film, The Thing, rather than just, like, the possibilities of the monster. Or rather, I mean, I feel like the monster is very closely connected to the overall kind of mood and tone of the film. So, we have a creepy shapeshifter monster, and because we don't know who is and isn't a monster, that heightens the sense of paranoia and suspicion that the kind of isolated environment already produces. Now, this is a problem for some modes of D&D play, because in modern D&D, and to be honest, in a lot of modes of older D&D, I believe that the kind of, like, wish fulfillment power fantasy that many old school heads criticize in modern D&D has actually been in D&D really from quite early on in its history. And thus from fantasy gaming in general. I mean, it's called a power fantasy. And for those players, a big part of the enjoyment is their character's ability to affect the world around them. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's a tendency to write about this in talking about fantasy gaming like it's, like, an inferior form of play, you know, like it's juvenile in some way. And, you know, having your character just constantly suffering and alone all the time is more, like, emotionally mature or whatever, and I don't find those arguments convincing. Let's just put it that way. But my point is simply that if the player group are interested in or accustomed to having that type of power and being able to sort of affect what goes on around them. And indeed, if the game has supplied them with the tools to easily detect who is and who isn't a monster, then, you know, they're going to have a problem, especially if the GM resorts to some kind of contrivance to take those things away. Now, I've said it before, but I think players will actually agree to a lot of kind of subversion of the game's premise because they enjoy the change of pace. That the premise of this scenario is that no one could have gone into this locked room to murder the professor and we have to figure it out, even though, like, in a D&D world, obviously there are many ways that people can get into a locked room. But people will buy into it for a one-shot, and I think that's probably true of the thing as well. But you do have to stay a little bit cautious because a lot of people, including me, have bad memories of, you know, games in which people tried to take away their funsies. And a lot of the stuff that is enjoyable about the thing is that kind of, like, low-level, forced creativity kind of feeling, you know. Given that you have a monster with these qualities, and given that you are just, like, the whole point about MacReady being the helicopter pilot is that he's not a scientist. He's just a regular guy. And so, a regular guy with certain resources available to him, and not able to get any more resources because he's in an Antarctic research base, has to combat this creature using improvisation and quick thinking and grit and determination and all that stuff. So lower level play is probably appropriate here, and older versions of the game will tend to facilitate this style a little bit more. So for example, I would say that, you know, once you get above, I think, like, third level, in 5th edition, you can reasonably expect, like, if there is a cleric in the party, mysteries kind of are much harder to implement because all that person has to do is wait until the morning and they can have Zone of Truth prepped. Some of them will have it prepped already. And that's much less the case if you're playing, like, BX, where comparatively few wizards at low levels have ESP as their go-to spell. So I think it is more common and more encouraged in some older versions of the game that PCs will use sort of in-world clue and analysis stuff to solve mysteries, whereas in later versions of the game, they're more likely to kind of look at their sheets and find their appropriate tools. I said that the earlier episode on shapeshifters is relevant for the thing, but actually, of course, because it's also an alien, so some of what I have said about alien monsters is relevant for running the thing. Part of the premise of the movie is that there is no pre-existing lore about this creature, right? It's not like a vampire where you can find someone who, you know, knows the ancient legends, or some wise man will turn up and tell you all about it. Now, the characters are scientists, but they only have the same, well, many of them are anyway, but they only have the same evidence that's available to anyone else. They don't have a lot of time to think about it. And so a lot of what they come up with is just based on inference from things that they find. And this, I think, does make it ideal for a role-playing game scenario, but hard to implement in a conventional D&D fantasy world, because the premise of the sort of science fictional discovery of monsters is that this is a shocking revelation. Previously, we believed that monsters did not exist, and now we have found out that this one does, so that's very frightening. As opposed to, like, oh, it's another monster. Well, okay, monsters are everywhere. So something to watch out for. If you want to do a thing like scenario in D&D, you have to manage that expectation. Also, one of the sort of important things about the setting is that the threat to the world needs to be contained. If the thing gets out of this very, like, limited environment and makes it into, like, a crowded city, it's going to be able to spread and it will be essentially undetectable. And again, that's something that you have to think about managing if you're doing a fantasy version of it. So if you have decided, okay, well, this is going to be a scenario for low-level player characters because that way they won't have, like, Zone of Truth or whatever, but then, okay, you are going to have to explain why this thing is still a threat to an entire world which contains, you know, canonically, much more powerful people than the player characters, whereas there is no one in the world who is better at dealing with the thing than MacReady. You know, he's exactly as capable of coping with this problem as anyone, which is to say, not very. But nobody has some better way to detect the monster than he does. Nobody has some better way to fight it than he does, because those things don't exist. This is interesting to me. You know, I've said that horror actually translates very well into fantasy, and maybe I need to narrow my thought here, because perhaps what I mean is gothic horror does, because essentially it consists of like a set of trappings, right? Anyway, I'll return to this thought later on. So to fantasyify the scenario, we need to think about the situation. It needs to be in a remote place that's hard to get access to. So it could be like a remote mountain fortress that's snowed in. It could be on a ship that's traveling to a port. Both of those would give us the ticking clock on the monster spreading. So, you know, even if it's not going to take over the world, if the monster gets to this port city, there's going to be mayhem, because think of all the thousands of people that could be affected before the Order of Paladins can be convinced that the monster exists and come and deal with it, right? We need to act now, now, now. And I think that's a very important part of the setting. Or similarly, if it's in the remote mountain fastness, well, it might be snowed in, but sooner or later that snow is going to melt. And that gives us an additional kind of random element to it, because you might not know what the day is that the weather is going to be good enough that it might get away, whereas you might have a reasonable expectation of when you arrive at your port. Although, having said that, travel by sea in the Age of Sail was actually a lot more unpredictable than we tend to give it credit for, because, you know, we think of it as analogous to traveling by train or airplane today, which are mostly, although not always, pretty reliable in terms of what time they turn up. You know, ships are at the mercy of the wind. Ships used to, like, suffer when they arrived at Jamaica, almost ready to land at Port Royal, but unable to do so until the wind changed, which could take days. Now, the paranoid atmosphere is another important part of the scenario, and that's quite challenging to manage, I feel. It's very yes or no for groups. Some are into it, and some really hate it, especially when you consider the possibility that a player character might be one of the people being impersonated. So what are we doing? Are we, like, scribbling notes on post-its and passing them back and forth to players at the table? Or are we doing the separation between in and out of character knowledge, and just, like, we as players are all appreciating the dramatic irony that we know who has been possessed, but our characters do not? Which is enjoyable, right? Some people work very, very hard to separate those types of knowledge, to make sure that they don't know anything that their character wouldn't know. But there's also a pleasure to be had in enjoying the irony of you knowing that what your character is about to do is going to get them in trouble and the character not knowing that. Now, that involves a certain type of, to use a bit of 4G jargon, stance relative to the player character that not everybody enjoys, right? People who value the sense of, like, quote-unquote, being the player character, they often don't appreciate that kind of thing. And a lot of people are sufficiently invested in, like, the competitive view of the game that they're not that interested in facilitating their characters being chumps who get fooled. And again, I don't blame them. This is often, like, looked down on as a more immature form of play, but that's, in my experience, that is often by people who want to, like, make you feel bad, feel like a chump. I may have unpleasant individual experiences which color my thinking about this, but I often get very defensive about the claim that wanting to succeed, wanting to do well, is somehow, like, not helpful in a game context. And I say that, you know, I would say that I am an averagely competitive and averagely ambitious player. I'm not squeezing the system till the pips squeak, but I also don't like to get punked unless we are playing a game in which the premise is that everybody gets punked. One way to sort out the more powerful characters arrive on the scene. So one way to sort out the problem of the scenario's relationship with the outside world, and maybe to allay some of the initial paranoia, is to actually not do quite the formula of the film The Thing, and have this be a situation that the characters enter into, where there are all these people that are trapped in this place, and they are paranoid that one of them is the shapeshifter, and they don't know who it is, and they don't really know, like, what is best to do, and then the PCs arrive. So the premise has kind of already been set up. Maybe as the blizzard comes down, they have to, like, make their way to this remote fortress just to find shelter, or maybe they find the ship drifting because most of the crew have already been killed by the thing, or whatever. You know, maybe they come down into a lower level of the dungeon and they find these dungeon explorers arguing about what to do about the shapeshifter that they have released with their mining. All of these are possibilities. And this could be a way in which the player characters come under collective suspicion because, like, oh, there has been a murder, and then a bunch of strangers show up. Well, these people might immediately assume that this has something to do with the thing and what it's up to. Older listeners and those with, like, a fondness for classic British TV sci-fi will realize that what I am describing is the characteristic plot of a Doctor Who episode from the mid to late 1960s, the Patrick Troughton era, where one of the most common formulas for a story was the so-called base under siege plotline, where you had the Doctor and his companions turn up at some kind of space station, moon base, tramp steamer, scientific research facility, whatever, that was surrounded by Ice Warriors or Cybermen or whatever. And this is a very popular format with the creators of the show because it allowed you to do a sci-fi action story that was nonetheless like a character-focused drama, right? So that we would have a bunch of characters, but not like a huge number, in a single location, and we could concentrate on the things that we were good at, which is just hire actors and get them to play parts, and de-emphasize the things that the show did not excel at, like having a lot of money to do armies of aliens or many locations, right? It's a budget story because it involves a small cast on a single location. But I think that the tricks that help the BBC conserve budget are also tricks that can help the GM conserve player attention. If you've ever played Brindlewood Bay, like I own but have not played The Between, the game that it is, as we heard in our episode with Jason Cordova, it's a spin-off, but actually it came out first. Brindlewood Bay is, that is. But in Brindlewood Bay, there are a finite number of suspects because there are a lot of murders where, like, theoretically you could always add another person. So in one of them, a man is killed while he's on his yacht. If you were doing this in a more free-form role-playing game, you could say, in addition to the staff and the other members of his family and the guests, a scuba diver could have come onto the boat and shoved him off or something like that. It could be anyone. But in Brindlewood Bay, that can't happen. There are X number of named suspects, and it must be one of them. Because the focus is on interacting with those suspects and with, like, the clues and constructing a narrative, a theory of the crime. So the same is true, I think, in a situation in your fantasy game where you're trying to create this type of suspicion, which is that you want to confine your number of potential suspects and potential victims to the number of people that your PCs are really going to keep track of. And it's easy to get carried away when you're creating these because GMs create characters in a different way than PCs interact with them. Worth remembering, once you get up above those five or six possible, you know, who's been replaced by the thing people are going to stop distinguishing between them very clearly. At least in my experience. Now, one thing that people like about The Thing is its general tone of bleak nihilism, right? And this is, to put it mildly, a mood that is hard to pull off in even the grimmest fantasy RPG. I mean, unless I miss my guess, the majority of trad games that try for gritty nihilism in the text tend to wind up in play as something like black comedy. Maybe my experiences are different, but I would say that in my experience, the majority of, like, Warhammer Fantasy roleplay games, for instance, are somewhere in the vicinity of, like, Blackadder, where the comedy to some extent results from the fact that the characters are in a stark and awful universe, but remain focused on their own petty problems. Now, like I said before, I think you can get players to go along with this for a bit, but it's hard to sustain long term. It's also, it doesn't make sense if you think about it, you know, to have a part of your experience be gritty nihilism. Like, nihilism is not, or shouldn't be, something you can just pick up and put down. But, you know, mood is mood, and it's not, like, this is not a philosophical statement that we're, like, analyzing to see how rigorous it is. It's a way that we feel for particular game sessions. And I think people are, in general, much more tolerant of that stitched-together feeling, especially in the kind of picaresque narrative of a typical D&D game, than you would expect them to be. You don't think about it like a novel, where sections with different kind of emotional tones and emotional weights can sometimes feel, like, jarring or intrusive. The science fiction aspect of it kind of doesn't land, and I think is sort of, you know, its role in the Carpenter thing and in the original story, I mean, other than that these stories exist within the genre of science fiction, like, you know, we tend to think of The Thing as a movie that introduces science fiction elements into a horror story, but I think in terms of publishing, the original novella would have been very much thought of as a science fiction story. The science fiction elements I think we have to discard because they're really secondary to the mood. They are introduced in the films because there needs to be a way to explain why monsters exist in a world where monsters otherwise do not exist. But obviously, we do not have that problem in a fantasy role-playing game where monsters presumably exist. So you can even have a kind of, like, very low fantasy, all monsters are unique kind of world, and still just say, like, well, there are nonetheless monsters in the world, and this is one of them, and not have to worry too much about introducing the sci-fi element. Because I think science fiction in early D&D in particular, so like the Expedition of the Barrier Peaks, everybody says, but I don't think that that is ever particularly used as a way to like expand the world. It's just kind of a one-off goof. People accept this scenario is in a different genre. And in a low fantasy world, introducing aliens kind of now means the game is about that thing, which is maybe not what you're trying to achieve here. I said earlier that D&D easily adopt the aesthetics and trappings of certain types of horror story. D&D and its descendants. So crumbling old castles, rickety coaches, moonlight moors, mad scientist labs, all that kind of thing. But the whole point about the thing is that it's a horror movie that doesn't have those horror movie trappings, but it does have a big dose of horror, which is the thing from horror movies that fantasy games actually don't adapt very well. I'll tell you what, though, the thing is a great lesson in monster presentation. The first time you encounter the monster in the movie, some humans are trying to kill it, but the protagonists don't know that, so they just see these seemingly ordinary people acting completely out of character, which is itself very unsettling. You know, if you were going down the dungeon hallway and you saw like a dog running the other way and you went, oh, you know, here comes the pup. And then after that came running a bunch of guys with burning torches trying to kill it, you would presumably think to yourself, you know, wow, what has gotten into the water supply and turned all these people into torch wielding maniacs? Not that dog's a shapeshifter. Even though that's a pretty reasonable conclusion in a D&D world. And the presentation of the monster is not like there's not much. You get some visual imagery that tells you about its origins as much as you need to know for the purpose of this story. And even though we have some kind of like classic sci-fi stuff in the thing, there's a flying saucer, for instance, the gruesome, visceral realism of the ways in which people interact with the monster, right? So, for example, they know that the thing fears fire. So in order to test who is really the thing, they take a sample of that person's blood and then try to stick a heated wire into it. And in one case, the blood actually recoils, which is a great image, and really goes some way, like your blood recoiling from this heated wire, or the absolutely hideous transformations and realizations that something is the monster. You know, they ground it in this physical reality that makes you think about the harms you could suffer, this kind of body horror, and that really reduces the way in which that kind of classic post-war sci-fi imagery, even though it's not post-war, the story, can feel a little safe and comforting. Not that people think that the creatures in flying saucers would be friendly, but that it is a familiar sight. In addition, the thing, the film, has some good thoughts about vulnerability, right? So the thing is vulnerable to fire. This, on the face of it, seems like a rather basic vulnerability. It makes you think of Pigeons from Hell, like the Robert E. Howard story, where the monster is vulnerable to lead and iron, which seem like very characteristic things that you would attack a monster with. But not if you are some lost travelers and a local police officer. You know, I guess the cop has a gun. But that is a radical escalation. Vulnerable to fire seems pretty run-of-the-mill. It's not exactly silver bullets, is it? But fire is a vulnerability that carries with it its own problems for the people using it. It reminds me a little bit of one of the very first vampire games I played in when I was a teenager. My character was being pursued by a vampire hunter. And one of my allies, who was not aware of who this guy was, saw a weird person following me around and decided to take him out. And so what he did was he drove a stake through his heart. Now, in Vampire the Masquerade, when you pull the stake out, the vampire will come back to life. But so he pulls the stake out and is like, oh, this is just a dead man. Yeah, like, yes, he dropped when you drove a wooden stake through his heart. That'll happen. Well, this thing was killed by lighting it on fire. You don't actually have to be a space alien to be killed by being lit on fire. You know, being on fire is bad for everybody. And also, fire can get out of control, can spread, can destroy your shelter. And remember, this is the only thing keeping you safe. You're in a hostile environment where if you don't have this base to be in, you could die. The physicality of the monster, I think, contributes to the ways in which people get creative about trying to identify the monster, unsuccessfully in some cases, because these are everyday protagonists, not battle-hardened monster hunters. But that creativity is fun because those characters are not far from the level of a moviegoer or an RPG player. They are doing things that the players could think to do themselves. And so the opportunity to kind of mess around and try to test different methods and see how they can identify the shape changer, I think is also a lot of fun. So you have to kind of put this scenario in a bubble a little bit. I like the deep in the dungeon idea. I like the on a boat idea. I like the player characters being outsiders to it, because otherwise it's quite hard to, with a typical kind of wandering PC party, it's hard to introduce them to the scenario in a way that feels low key enough that it matches the sort of tone of the thing, but urgent enough that they don't decide to just pick up and leave. So you want like a physical bubble of confinement, a gradual buildup to the realization, or dumping them in media res into the middle of a conflict that's already happening with these other characters, and perhaps, you know, reflecting the tone of paranoia by having those other characters be suspicious of outsiders. And then establishing pretty early on some basic ground rules for the monster that the PCs can experiment with, and maybe making the monster like not vulnerable to most of the attacks the PCs have. And I think if you can do that, then a shape-shifting monster doesn't have to be that tough to take out these dungeon exploring NPCs, and yet still perhaps pose a threat to the player characters. And I think there, like, you're starting to get into pretty good territory for like the tone and atmosphere of John Carpenter's The Thing. Now, you'll notice that I haven't really talked about like the monster and its stats. That's because D&D is lavishly supplied with gruesome shapeshifters. Or you could just take any creature and give it polymorph as a spell, and I think you're good to go. The limitations on the monster are important, but I think you can easily just apply those, you know, to the shape-shifting goober of your choice. And this also allows you to adapt it to the capabilities of your party, because there are, you know, more and less powerful shape-shifting creatures. All right, so that's all the time we have today to talk about John Carpenter's 1982 classic, The Thing, a movie that, if I got any details wrong about it, I think it's probably been 20 years since the last time I saw it, so maybe a little bit less, but it has been a long time. Still, Greg, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed the episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to get your own special episode, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're gonna be taking a look at an unusual new creature from 1993's Monsters Manual. So I hope that you will join me then, right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.